Welcome to the River Talk podcast, hosted by Priscilla Macy, Zach Collier, and me, Eric Weissa. This week, we are going to be talking about social media and how it influences boating. But we always like to start with news of the week, so here we go. I'll go ahead and start, Zach, with, Priscilla's gone this week. She's off in D.C. doing rad Priscilla things. Yeah. So this week, it's just Zach and I.
Thanks, Priscilla. We miss you, but thank you for doing that, the hard work. And I think Priscilla said she wanted to try to do an episode from D.C. next week and give us an update. So hopefully we can make that happen.
That sounds awesome. Yeah. So my news of the week this week is last week I talked a little bit about the steelhead or projected steelhead fishing closure here in Idaho due to some conflicts between a couple environmental groups and the Idaho Fish and Game and some paperwork that Fish and Game didn't get accomplished with NOAA and everything else. A big complicated deal. But the end result is the steelhead season is being closed here at midnight on December 7th. And that is going to be nothing short of catastrophic for some of these rural Idaho communities that, from a financial standpoint, essentially depend upon steelhead fishing and what it brings to their town. So that's both, you know, guided fishing and clients and that kind of thing. So a lot of river guides who are going to be out of work, river companies that depend on that winter business, but then also hotels, restaurants, you know, gas stations, all these kinds of things that feed these sort of out in the middle of nowhere, small little towns like Riggins, you know, population 300. They changed over to sort of a tourism economy from old logging community. And now that tourism is just going to dry up for the winter out of nowhere because of this. And so it's going to be really, really hurtful to a lot of people, what's happening. And
so Eric, this is a done deal. Like it's definitely going to be closed.
It's definitely, I mean, it is going to be closed unless something changes. Wow. And talking with Fish and Game, basically what they're saying is there's two ways this gets resolved. Way one is the paperwork gets through at NOAA relating to this endangered species stuff. And, you know, then the season will open up back up. Because what precipitated this was a threat of lawsuit from a coalition of, I believe, six environmental organizations saying the state is out of compliance with the Endangered Species Act because of this, that, and the other. And, you know, this paperwork hasn't gone through NOAA. And because you're operating illegally, if you don't get this solved in the next 6 weeks or whatever it was, 8 weeks, 60 days, we are going to file a lawsuit in 60 days if you don't get this figured out. And then they kind of came to the table and negotiated and said, if, you know, we will drop the lawsuit if you guys change these, this, that, and the other and do these things. And Fish and Game came back and said, we can't do that. And then according to Fish and Game, they eventually got to an agreement and the organization had to go back to their members, came back the next day and said, we can't do it. And that's, it all sort of fell apart. So the two ways that could be solved are one, NOAA gets the paperwork done. The state is now in compliance. Everything opens back up, which according to Fish and Game, they're projecting that that could it will happen. It just may not be till March, April, May. By then the fishing season's over anyway, and the damage has been done. The other way that this gets solved is this coalition of, you know, six or seven organizations, whatever it was, with a good chunk of them being out of the state people, basically commit to saying we will not file a lawsuit, and then Fish and Game can open things back up. If these organizations come back and say we won't file a lawsuit, we'll give you 6 months or whatever it is to get the paperwork in order, we promise not to sue you in that period of time, then Fish and Game can open the season back up. But these organizations thus far have refused to do that, and so that is where it is. So that's where it is.
Does this just affect commercial fishing, or does it also affect private fishing too?
Everybody. Okay. There is no steelhead fishing in the state of Idaho after December 7th. And potentially, I mean, it could go on if NOAA takes a while in their paperwork. I mean, it could be all of 2019. So this is, I mean, it's going to affect Fish and Game revenue because people aren't going to be going out on January 1st to buy their new fishing license and steelhead tags and all that. It's going to affect retail stores where people buy fishing equipment. It's going to affect any town where people go to go fishing. It's going to affect, you know, boat companies. And I mean, there's a long list of people who suffer, shuttle companies, et cetera, because of this statewide. But then, you know, yeah, your outfitters and guides are going to be hit really hard.
Would you file this? Would you file this under, like, is this an actual environmental issue they're addressing, or is this like overzealous environmental groups, or is this incompetent government?
I would say it's all of the above.
Okay.
In some way or another, right? There's incompetent government. The only reason the lawsuit exists is that Fish and Game didn't get their paperwork done in an orderly fashion. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've been out of compliance essentially for 8 years. But they've been working with NOAA to prioritize other things, like dealing with hatchery stuff. And there's some other projects that they prioritized because they just felt they were more, that was more important. And NOAA told them that they could just keep going as they were. So there's the government incompetence piece. I don't think there's any question, from that standpoint. There is the very real environmental issue of fish runs are not recovering. You know, the steelhead were listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. Yeah. And, you know, for good reason. And we're not seeing growth in those numbers. So that's a very real issue. And then, you know, there's the overzealous environmental group here where what they've accomplished here is they're not going to affect real change, because, you know, Fish and Game, instead of being at risk of a lawsuit, where if there was a lawsuit, then there could be some real consequences to what fishing looks like in the state of Idaho in the future. Mm-hmm. But since Fish and Game just shut it down, there's not going to be a lawsuit. And when the paperwork gets done, it's going to be opened back up and things are going to be exactly as they were.
I'm pretty naive to all of this because I'm not involved and I don't fish. So I'm going to ask a very naive question. Wouldn't it be the case that if people didn't fish, that would be good for steelhead?
Well, so let me premise what I'm about to say with a couple of things. One, I am the world's worst angler.
I don't know. I bet I could be worse.
You put me on the Rogue with the fly rod. Like, I can catch fish on the Rogue with a fly rod because that's where I grew up fishing. I know how to fish there. It's really not that hard. Like, the Rogue is a pretty easy. I mean, people joke about like how fly fishing on the Rogue isn't really fly fishing.
Yeah.
So like you take me somewhere else and I'm pretty terrible. That's one. And two, it's just not my passion. I'm not a passionate.
Yeah.
I row a drift boat because I like rowing a drift boat, not because I really want to go fishing all that bad. Like fishing to me is an opportunity to row my drift boat more than just to go fishing.
Yeah.
But I mean, yes, I guess that's probably true. I mean, there's so many points to this argument that there's people who argue that, you know, fish hatcheries, that's one of these groups that's their big issue is the fish hatcheries. They want the fish hatcheries to go away because they are arguing that the hatchery fish take resources from the wild fish.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's arguments about people fishing for hatchery fish, catch wild fish, and then there's mortality rate when you catch them and all that kind of stuff. And all of that stuff, I'm sure there's, you know, probably some truth behind all of that. Right. But decimating people's lives for, you know, like one season doesn't affect long-term change or benefit. So the better thing to do would be to have a long-term strategy where, you know, these anglers want healthy fisheries. These environmental groups want healthy fisheries. How can we work together to not destroy people's lives and have long-term protection enacted to make, you know, lasting sort of systemic change that's going to help protect these species? You know, like one of the big things here in Idaho, the belief is, and makes sense to me, and I've, you know, people who know a hell of a lot more about it than I do seem to consistently say that one of the main things that's decimating fish populations up here is the dams on the lower Snake River.
Yeah.
And they'd like to see those go away. You know, your fishing community up here is huge. Like, they're a huge supporter of that, of those going away because they want good fish runs. These environmental groups want those to go away because they want good fish runs. So there's a huge opportunity for partnership and collaboration and to have a really powerful, large political voice to accomplish those ends if we can work together. But what instead is happening now is these environmental groups are ostracizing this huge community of people that are on their side through getting this fishing season shut down and ruining people's livelihoods. You know, my hope is that they can kind of come together and figure out some sort of common ground. and get these groups to back off the cliff a little bit and let people, you know, have their fishing season in the hope that we can make long-term change to protect fish.
Yeah.
And protect an industry up here and protect, you know, healthy fisheries.
I'm going to boil this down to, I'm going to try to simplify this in my brain. And something that I think about a lot, the people who are the Republican outdoorsy types, in this case, the fishermen and fisherwomen anglers, who are like, you know, wearing cowboy hats and cowboy boots and jeans and belt buckles, you know, they're not talking to the environmentalists who are wearing organic cotton, Patagonia, and I don't know, whatever they wear. And so there's like two cultures here who don't talk, and that they, I think the solution to this comes from them talking and finding common ground. And if they don't talk, their views get further and further apart, and they get more like caught up in their like they're like, we won't cross this line. They won't move at all because the other group won't move at all. And hopefully moving forward, the two groups can sit down and get to know each other. And I think that trust, it's going to be hard to make it happen quickly. Like that trust happens over many years. And so hopefully this reminds us that we need to talk to the other side more, sit down with them, you know, and form a relationship for when something like this comes up.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. You know, and I think there are one of the groups, one of the Idaho-based groups of this coalition does have a long history of working with the sort of outfitting, you know, more cowboy hat wearing community of folks to accomplish a lot of really good things in the past here in the state of Idaho. And yet, you know, they're finding themselves kind of, I think, on the wrong side of this one.
Yeah.
And so the hope is that, yeah, those, you know, in the immediate term, there can be some of those leveraging of past relationships. And then in the long term, you know, my hope would be that we can start seeing more relationship build. I mean, we talked about this a little bit last week, how there's more people coming out making the argument that the environmental groups and the sportsmen's groups, for the lack of a better term, you know, your hunter, fisher, those kinds of people, that they have there's a lot of common goals amongst these groups, and everybody would benefit if they can figure out how to get along.
Yeah.
And talk together. You know, I think there's a lot of pieces to it. I think you're right that you get these groups that don't talk to each other because they sort of assume that they're at opposites when in reality they're not.
They're not. I mean,
I think there's a physical location piece too. As someone who just moved to like rural Idaho, you know, there's sort of a belief that these environmental groups are like your city folk and there's, you know, and then kind of the fisherman, hunter, those kinds of people are like your country folk. And because they just don't live in the same places, there's not a whole lot of relationships there either.
Yeah.
But anyway, that is the steelhead issue as it sits today. And I'm sure we'll have updates going forward.
So it sounds like it's done. It's closed for this year. Like there's not much of a chance to open it back up. Like these communities and the people who work steelhead guiding and the people who plan vacations to do it, like they're all going to be negatively impacted this year.
Yeah, I mean, the hotel, I'll talk about Riggins just because it's where I'm close to and, you know, one of our businesses is based and everything else. But like they're putting signs up on the hotel in town is putting signs up on their outside board, like closing doors December 8th because nobody's going to be here.
I mean, as a tourism, I have a tourism business like this. I feel so bad for them. I mean, if I didn't have my business, I guess I could work at McDonald's or Starbucks or take tolls at the toll booth. I don't know what else I would do to make a living. It's a huge, huge hit. There's that, but also the people who have already booked flights and planned vacations around steelhead fishing in Idaho, you know, I feel bad for them because now they can't do what they want to do.
The closest thing I can, you know, I was thinking about this yesterday as we were having a conversation with somebody else about it. The closest thing I could compare this to from my experience has been like forest fires. When forest fires shut down the Rogue this year, a little bit on the day stretch, but when they shut down the Wild section back in, gosh, what would that have been like? 2013. Like that was, you know, economically catastrophic, emotionally catastrophic, like all of those things. And for these people, like that's what they're staring down, except it's not, you know, a 10-day closure where you're going to get it back and opened up.
It's because of a lack of paperwork being filled out by the government. I mean, that's what's going to be really frustrating.
And a lack of, I think, I think it's, yeah, it's like at a base level, yes, it's a lack of paperwork being filed out by organizations that are underfunded and under-resourced, yeah, and understaffed for all the shit they have to do.
Yeah.
And then at a secondary level, by, you know, an unwillingness to see the humanity of those that are going to suffer on the other side by some people and organizations out of state.
And this is a reminder to me, you know, like, Eric, you're very involved in Idaho Outfitters and Guides Association and the Wild Outfitter. You're the president of the Wild
Rogue Outfitters Association.
I should know the name of it. And
you're on the board, so you should.
I should know the name of it. I'm the treasurer. I write checks. But also, like, you know, we're both involved in Oregon Outfitters and Guides Association. And these, how important these associations are, because as individuals, we can't go out there and solve these problems all the time. But hopefully these associations are looking into this and we're pooling funds from a big group to do it. And same thing with private boaters. Like, there's the Oregon Whitewater Association, which doesn't take political stances, but, you know, at least they come together to do some things. And there's an Idaho Whitewater Association. And I'm more and more realizing how important it is that we are active members of these organizations that can kind of oversee government and also have, you know, interact with other nonprofit groups that may have different motives.
No, you're totally right. It's, you know, Idaho Outfitter and Guides Association was in the governor's office yesterday,
yeah,
talking about this issue.
And is this why you're involved in this issue, because you're on the board?
I'm involved in this issue for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, obviously being on the board of IOGA, it's like, I obviously see it's now put in front of me and I have a responsibility as a board member to, yeah, be a part of that. But more importantly, this is going to ruin friends' lives. Like, I have friends who this is going to, like, financially, like, be devastating for. You know, friends who are fishing guides, friends who own companies that, you know, fish in the wintertime. Like, that's how they, you know, put food on their table all winter long, yeah, when it's not summer season. Like, I have personal relationships where this is going to drastically impact people. And it's very easy to see, you know, again, I can compare it to fires for me, where the causes are very different, but the the experience is very similar, right? Although probably a little less frustrated on the fire side, just because it's not like a human.
Well, you can blame George Bush for making climate change happen.
I'm not going to at this point. bigger conversation. But, you know, so I can empathize with what they're going through. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, I want to segue into something.
It's all fronts.
I want to segue into my news of the week, and I'll try to make it short. On this same topic, I have started a new association, the Calmiopsis Guides Association, which is an association of river guides and private boaters and trail workers who work in the Calmiopsis wilderness. And that includes the Illinois River and the Chetco River and the upper North Fork of the Smith. For this exact thing, like, I just think there's conversations that river guides need to be involved in. And we don't have a voice right now. The voices are environmental groups, which are doing a really good job. But sometimes what they're doing is at odds with those of us that work in the wilderness. And those of us that actually work there and spend time there have our own unique perspective that we can take to lawmakers. And so my project this year was to start this organization. And it's been an interesting project. And we have 8 members. And, you know, if you're a guide in the Calmiopsis, which includes private boaters, if you take people on Illinois trips, that counts to me. You know, it's $15 a year, and it helps us have a bigger voice talking to lawmakers. So that's my news of the week. We're announcing the official beginning of this association.
Exciting. Very exciting.
Yeah, it's fun, and I'm really proud of it. And even if there's only, like, 10 members, that allows us to go to lawmakers and say, hey, I represent 10 people who work here. You know, instead of just me, like, hey, I care personally. I'm with an association that represents 10 members or 100 or whatever it is. And this is what we think should happen in this area that we care about.
Well, I'm sure it's going to grow to 9 members because, you know, we run shuttles in the Illinois. Yeah. So, well, we should join.
You should join. You should join individually, though, as somebody who likes
the Illinois. Yeah. And likes the Chetco.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you could, $15 a year, you can join. And Orange Torpedo can join as well. Or Whitewater Cowboys.
I love that you started another organization. It's like, you don't have enough going on, Zach. That's what you need, another organization.
I need to quit some organizations and stop being on boards. But this one, well, this one really matters to me. And here, the big thing is, you know, when I go talk to, in Oregon, my representative is Greg Walden. He's a Republican. And, you know, every time I mention his name around my friends, people boo. But I think that he quite possibly could care about the environment. I don't know for sure. But whenever an environmental group sets up an appointment for me to meet him, he doesn't ever meet with me. But whenever like a business group sets up an appointment, that's when I've had a meeting with them. And I feel like I want a group that is middle of the road that can get a meeting with Republican lawmakers and maybe ask them to do some things. You know, say, hey, we work here. We support the economy of the area. Can you do some things to support business in this wilderness area? You know, instead of yep. like, hey, just, you know, save some frogs and some tadpoles and some butterflies. You know, we're like, hey, you know, save our economy. And it's just another voice that needs to exist down there. And so it's something that I care about. So I'm doing it. You know, it's more work, but luckily I have a little bit of time to do it.
I think that, you know, we'll move on after this, but that's a really good point about, you know, these trade organizations. And I've been accused of this by some of the rafting companies or some of the private groups out there of, you know, like IOGA, WROA, like yeah. all of those sort of rafting trade groups. Like, we are environmental groups.
Yeah.
You know, like, we do a ton of things that would fall under the environmentalism category because we're passionate about these places we get to share. We love them and want them to be places that we can still share with people 50 years from now and have them be the same as they are today, you know, and as spectacular as they are today and all that kind of stuff. And so, yes, we have a financial vested interest, but we also, just like everybody in environmental groups, have an emotional connection to these places
yeah.
and want them protected. So you could do both, you know, for us, it's both. It's yeah, you're right. It's industry, but it's also the environmental side, I think, for most of our members.
And I think the new generation of outfitters, you know, Eric, when you and I started doing this career that we've chosen, you know, I think the outfitters before that, some of them cared, but a lot of them were just there to make money. And I would say that, you know, new outfitters care a lot more. And most outfitters I know have some involvement in some sort of conservation projects or groups. And so I think that's just a new world where people who are outfitters and guides are more involved in conservation and caring about the places they work. Where
I think that a lot of the front end of it, really, like you think, yeah. I think there's a number of outfitters I can think of who are on the front end of sort yeah. of conservation efforts.
Yeah. Yep.
So,
hey, anyway. I know our topic is social media, but this made me think of another topic that I want to bring up all related to this. That's actually an interesting one. And I'm going to put off social media for a second. I had a long conversation with my friend Aaron yesterday, who's been on our podcast before. And he thinks that the Colorado should be a wild and scenic river. I don't know if you know this or not, but the Grand Canyon, the Colorado River, is not a wild and scenic river. And it doesn't flow through wilderness. It's strictly in a national park.
Yes.
And so he's proposing, hey, it should be a national wild and scenic river. What do you think about that, Eric? What's your first impression about that?
Well, maybe we're just going to highlight my ignorance here.
I would say most people didn't know that.
Well, it doesn't really surprise me, but my question is what would it gain? What protections would it gain by being a wild and scenic river that it doesn't have now under the national park?
This is what
national parks come with, like all sorts of stuff, right?
Yep. So this is what I said, Aaron, I mean, I get it, but why? What's the point? And really, we from the discussions, there's a couple things it gets. One, when it's a wild and scenic river, there's no more dams allowed. That's the biggest thing it does, is it doesn't allow for dams. And there are, you know, I don't think it'll ever be dammed. I can't imagine that ever happening. But this will be sure it never happens. You know, there's just zero chance once it's a wild and scenic river. And the other thing, it gets a management plan that manages its outstandingly remarkable values, which on the Grand Colorado, there's like five of them. It's like scenery, geology, recreation, fish and wildlife, I think. It has a bunch of these values. And what I told Aaron, I go, because he's a guide there, he cares about it being protected. And I go, Aaron, making it wild and scenic, you know, could add protections to the river for sure. And that's a good thing, right? You agree that's a good thing. But it also could create restrictions you're not happy with, right? Like the humpback chub is an endangered fish in the Colorado River. What if, because that's its value and it's protected, there are additional regulations put on rafting and kayaking in the Grand Canyon? Would you accept that? So the bigger question is do we care more about our ability to go in there and do trips, whether it's commercial or private, or do we care more about the place? What if it's even more restrictive?
It's an interesting, because I like, my takeaway is that the National Park Service is already so hard to work with.
Yeah.
That it's hard to imagine like more restrictions, you know?
That's what he said. He said there's not going to be any more restrictions than there are now. It's crazy right now. I go, I get it. There's going to be something, Aaron. There's going to be one thing. Like, they're going to realize that the chub to protect.
If there's not going to be something, then what's the point? It's like, there's only so much bandwidth for effort to do things in the world. And it's like, if it's not going to change anything, and then
why I said, why don't you protect a different river? Like, take all this energy to make the Colorado wild and scenic. Why don't we go make a different river that is actually being threatened by dams? That was my point to him. Like, I wouldn't say no to it, but I also would rather us focus our energy somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Grand Canyon is like an iconic, has now become sort of the iconic American image in a sense.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine at least anything within the national park, you know, changing.
But when you look at the National Wild and Scenic River system, it's embarrassing that the Colorado is not in it. So just from a purely like, it should be in it kind of thing. Like, yeah, it should be there, but maybe from a policy perspective, it's maybe not a priority.
Yeah.
Anyway, this kind of ties into
interesting. I didn't know that. It makes sense. I mean, in such a long river with so many great sections, like the Colorado is unique in just that there are so many really cool parts of it.
This is tied into your first discussion. Like, do we care? Like, let's say that fishing does affect the fish. Like, I would imagine that steelhead don't do better when people fish them. I don't know for sure. Maybe I'm wrong.
That seems like a pretty easy assumption, right?
So,
like,
yeah, but there's some people who will say, well, fishermen pay for, like, people who pay for fishing licenses pay for more hatchery fish or more protection. And I don't know, maybe it actually makes them stronger. I have no idea. But the question is, what do we choose when we have to decide between protecting the place and our ability to recreate there? What happens when those come to a head?
Well, yeah, it's we've seen that. So here's a couple. Let's put real world examples on that. You know, you've probably spent some time like hiking in the Three Sisters Wilderness area, you know, climbing South Sister and Broken Top and all that kind of stuff, I'm sure.
I've hiked there, but I've never climbed those peaks. I've done a little bit of hiking.
You should climb South Sister. It's a fun, you know, it's a reasonable day hike. Oregon's third largest mountain, tallest mountain.
I'm afraid of heights. Will that be a problem?
No, it's a trail. Like, the first time I did it, I think we were 12 and we did 2 days and we were near the top. And we got passed by some like 80-year-old in trail running gear, just like rallying up. And he went to the top, touched the top, came back down. We were still going up. So, you know, anybody can do it. It's just it's a steep hike. But they are going to, I think this was announced here recently, they're going to start a permit system to go into that area and hike because it's being overrun by people. You know, this is a common conversation in Oregon, especially. And, you know, other places as well, Grand Canyon National Parks, we've talked about it a little bit, of being visited to death, right? And so all of a sudden now too many people are going to these places and they're destroying them. Three pools, Thor's Playroom, whatever you want to call it, on the, was that Opal the North Creek. Fork of the, yeah, Opal Creek?
North Fork of the Sandium.
Yeah, like that's one of those examples of a place that in some ways is like loved to death, right? So how do you deal with that? And ultimately, that's where all the protections, I mean, that's how, that's why the Rogue was protected. Same thing. Like, the Rogue is the way it is today because at some point somebody saw that this place is going to be loved to death.
Yeah.
So we need to limit people going there. And while it's painful at the time, I think examples of the Rogue, the salmon, et cetera, are evidence that if we want these places to be as special as they are today, we want them to be that special 50 years from now. We have to be willing to sacrifice some things now, maybe some freedoms or some access or whatever, to ensure that our kids and grandkids get to enjoy them the same way we do.
Yeah.
You know, it's here in Idaho on the hunting side, This is a huge issue that I fully don't understand. Although it's been explained to me probably 10 times and I just cannot get my head around it. It is like hunting allocation tag stuff. And there was a lot of elk outfitters when wolves really started to kind of come back into Idaho. The elk populations got somewhat decimated in places. And so there was a lot of elk hunting outfitters who basically stopped, like they reduced the number of hunters they were taking out because they didn't feel that the elk populations could sustain what their business had done in the past.
Wow. On their own, without regulation, they just did it on their own. Wow.
Right. Well, even further on their, like not, they were not regulated to do it. They did it because they felt it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And now there's a whole issue with use it or lose it kind of stuff. And some of those outfitters are now going to be punished.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to have use taken away from them because they did the right thing. And so in the state, there's a whole issue right now with, you know, that debate going on that, again, like because of IOGA, I've become aware of and tried to get involved in, but just cannot fully understand all the nuances of it. But there are people out there who do that and sacrifice business and everything else because they're afraid that if they don't, it's going to have long-term detriment to
and the people who
whatever the resource is.
And let's say there's a handful of outfitters that didn't slow down their
hunting. For sure is a handful of outfitters.
Those ones are probably getting increased. They're probably, oh, you guys are killing it. You should get more access now. So they're probably being positively rewarded for that.
That's exactly what the argument is. Yeah.
Well, let's go on to our topic because we could beat this to death. And I think it's kind of related, and it's social media and how that affects boating.
Yeah. Well, is your topic Zach?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, when you think about Opal Creek and people who go there, I think a lot of the reasons these places get popular is because they make really good Instagram photos. And so people see it on Instagram and that's how they learn about it and they go there. And then they take their own Instagram photo and it kind of spreads the place to more and more people, and it makes certain spots heavily trafficked. I'm guessing that might be happening at South Sister too. But my bigger topic is, does social media change your boating? Like where you boat, when you boat, what you do, and is that okay? And my thesis is that in 2018, all of us have smartphones and social media on our phones. We are different people than we were in 2007. And I mean, we're almost androids now. I mean, that phone has basically like turned us into an android. Like we have, you know, it's not part of our body yet, but it's in our hand all the time. And we're constantly in touch with our friends and we're getting weather and we're getting everything. And we're seeing what our friends are doing on a real time basis. It's crazy if you step back and look at it, but it's the reality. I don't think it's going to change. And I think that social media has motivated more people to boat and boat maybe harder stuff and brag about it. And maybe that's okay.
I think it's hard to imagine that that's not true. You know, you and I have talked about this before. I mean, there's science out there or studies out there showing sort of the physical effects on your body when you're getting like positive review, when you're getting likes and stuff on social media, that there's actual physical things happening in your body that feed that. And so
in your brain, there's like chemicals, like I think it's dopamine in your brain. Like every time you check and you get more likes, that creates dopamine in your brain, which is a positive reinforcement. And you want to keep doing it. If you're at home bored, depressed, a great way to cheer yourself up is check how many likes you got.
Yeah. You know, and you're getting to curate sort of your image, you know, self-image and all that kind of stuff. Like there's all sorts of pieces to that. And that then, you know, promotes us to maybe do things that are not the wisest. You know, fun example, my little brother, not so little anymore, but he started a social Facebook or no Instagram page called Sports and Jorts. And it was him doing all sorts of things in jorts. And that included like backcountry skiing and all this other stuff. And so, you know, like one morning he goes out and it's 10 degrees or whatever, climbs Mount Superior in right across the road from Alta, snowbird, and skis one of the classic lines in the Wasatch in waist deep powder. It's like 3,000 vertical feet, waist deep powder. It's 20 degrees out in jorts. you know, and he did it for a lot of reasons, but I would say primarily it was for the great Instagram photos.
Yeah.
You know, and then you have to hitchhike back up to your car and there he is like hitchhiking in his jorts, you know, photos of him doing it and stuff. And so you make choices like that was probably a pretty questionable choice from a safety standpoint. He ended up being like, it was fine. But, I could see a lot of scenarios where people are doing, we used to go out. I mean, it's like, there's sort of a joke of, well, if you're not Instagramming it, then what's the point? Uh-huh. Right. And you, everybody jokes about that, but there's also a little bit of truth in most people's minds when they're doing it, I suspect.
And I'm going to make the point here, and I'm going to play devil's advocate, that maybe that's the world we live in now. Like, maybe it's not enough just to go kayaking, that, you know, you like part of what we, how we live our lives is doing things that we share with the world. And that like maybe, and probably the case now, maybe in 2028, like this isn't even a question, right? You just like, you live your life through your phone, through what you, or by then it'll be an implanted device or whatever. But like your choice of what you do is based on how it, you explain it to the world.
Yeah. I, you know, the good, bad, ugly of it all. I, you know, I've got my opinions on sort of the goods and, or the ways that I think it's harmful to, what, you know, individuals, me, or society, all that.
What's your opinion? Like, that's what I want to hear.
Well, it opens up an opportunity for us to, or for me, cause I've done it and do it, to sort of have this outward appearance that I have curated to show exactly what I want to show. So like if you go to my Instagram page, you're going to see exactly what I want you to see about me. It paints an image of what my life looks like, even though in reality, that is like this small fraction of what my life really is. Uh-huh. You know, it's me out on adventures with my kids or out backcountry skiing or out doing these things. And like all of those things happen and those are a part of my life. But if you look at like the total hours in my week, the number of hours that I'm out doing those kinds of things versus the hours I'm sitting in front of my computer and answering phones or, you know, doing some other sort of not Instagrammable.
So why don't thing. You once in a while post a photo of you behind your computer?
I, you know, cause
it's boring.
I don't find it all that fascinating and it's not part of that image of my life I really want to curate.
Okay.
My wife has a good friend, Laura Tremaine, and she does this thing every year on Instagram that it's like, show your day, you know, and it's like take a picture of everything that you did throughout your day. Like, what does your whole day look mm-hmm. like? And it's all of the mundane parts of life to kind of show that and showcase what life actually looks like for you. And I think that's fascinating. I've always felt like, one, it's, you know, to me personally, it seems like a whole lot of effort and time, but I do think it's fascinating because it shows such a different side than what I feel like social media typically shows.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the negative to it is it allows me to sort of create this. And then ultimately I think you start to believe it, or at least I found that I do. And I know people where I've seen in their lives where it seems like that's kind of it is you then start to believe it influences what you believe about yourself and what you value and all that kind of stuff ultimately. Cause that's what's getting reinforced is positive through all your likes. And everything else. I'm no psychologist. I'm just making this up as I go, but that's been my perception. So don't, but, I feel like you need to listen to it too much.
But did you have some realization you stopped doing it or are you still doing it?
I have definitely at times in my life realized that like I posted something. If I posted something online or on Instagram, Facebook, whatever, I'm looking at my phone 20 times more that day than if I didn't.
To see the
like
see
I
the
know
response.
That about myself for sure. Oh yeah, for sure. Because it feels good. You know, and like I've had the opportunity to reflect on that a little bit and realize that's not a healthy thing. Like that, there's a lot of pieces of addiction that sound very similar.
Yeah.
So that's a little concerning. Doesn't mean I've stopped doing it. Although there've been periods where I've tried to really cut it down. But to the positives, one of the things I really value about Instagram, and especially when I lived in Utah, you always knew what the snow was doing and where it was good and what kind of things people were skiing through Instagram. It's like, oh, well, I'm not going to go ski this because I know it was already skied this morning. Or I know that the snow is good at this aspect of this elevation because I've seen 5 people skiing it, you know, on Instagram today. So you always could have a sense of what's going on. Same thing with boating. Like oh, here's a creek I've never heard of. I've seen it. This looks super fun.
Yeah, I've always wondered. I should get out there and check it out. Or yeah. The other thing is through Facebook, there's all these groups that are like, you know, that you can be a part of that say, oh, there's a log here. Watch out for this. You know, before back in the day, you would call a flow line and they'd say all the phone.
Oh,
the
flows. Yeah.
And now you're just like, somebody posts to Instagram. You're like, oh, cool. That looks good. I'm going to go right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's totally right. So it opens up the access to things out there, and knowledge of what's available is so much better.
Yeah.
And there's safety sides to that for sure. I think it also takes some of the adventure out of it. You know, back when it was like, we'd read Soggy Sneakers and it had a 2-paragraph description of whatever the run was. And you knew the put in, the take out, the optimal flows, and maybe a few of the key things. And then it was like total, you know, you didn't know anything else.
Yeah.
Now you can YouTube run every rapid on damn near every run.
Or like back when you had Soggy Sneakers, you would go do this run and think you were really special. Like, man, probably nobody's run that in 3 weeks and you feel really cool. Now you can go on Instagram and there's a photo of somebody running it that day, running the thing you portaged. And like, man, I'm not that cool. Like ignorance was a little bit of, you know, ignorance is bliss back in the day when you could think you're pretty rad. And now you can.
Or Strava.
Like, I just crushed a lap. Yeah.
And then you realize you're like the 50th fast person, like 50th fastest person that day.
Yeah. I want to ask you about this too, because, you know, there's the part of us individually going boating and posting, and like, does it affect our boating? And I'm going to make the claim that I'm cool. I just think it's how the world's going to be. Like, I think that we're kind of kicking and screaming about it right now, but like 5 years from now, it's just, you just do it. Everybody just does it. And it's normal to post about what you do. And we're a different culture in 5 years. And right now we're in a transition phase about it. But what do you think when you're boating and somebody's like, Hey, wait 5 minutes so I can set up this Instagram shot. Do you think it should be like you just do it on the fly and you don't affect the trip? Or are you cool with somebody who's like, hey, let me pull over, climb up this cliff and like stage the shot that I want? I just did a trip with a guy who kept staging things and he'd be like, oh yeah, go back and do that again. That was really cool. And I'm like, really? I have to like, you know, that was frustrating to me, having to like restage something that was cool.
Yeah, I definitely have like a tolerance for it, but it only lasts so long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, all right, if you're going to run ahead and go set up, take a photo real quick, you know, whether I use it for social media or not, like I like having those things. You know, I turn on my computer, they're on my screensaver. I get to remember experiences and adventures, you know, down the road. Like I'm a big fan of pictures, whether you post them socially or not. I like having photos of adventures. So I'm big into, hey, I'll go ahead or you go ahead, take photo, that kind of thing. Cause I think that's fun. But I don't like sitting around. So I have a pretty low tolerance for if it's going to take you more than 2 minutes and we're going to do it a lot, it's going to start to drive me insane.
Yeah.
There are definitely people I have adventured with who it got to really get on my nerves for sure. Like, Jesus, like we're never going to get where we need to go because we're taking too damn many pictures.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in my mind, I'm like, oh, it's getting dark. Like, or it's, you know, I know we have 3 hours of paddling and it's going to be dark in 3.5 hours. I don't want to stop here and do this stage, this shot right now because it's a cool gear shot for somebody who you want to get to sponsor you.
Yeah. And I'm also, you know, there's definitely been times in my life where I've been the hike back up and take the photo person, but I'm pretty rare on that one.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, we'll take the photo if it's on the way and then we're going to keep going is more my mentality.
So there's the but we both run businesses. We both try to get attention. How important do you think social media is for your business then? So there's the personal, like I'm going kayaking, I'm going to show off, you know, whether or not that's, you know, valuable for us as people and our own egos or whatever. But then like, how do you think it's valuable for your business to be posting on social media?
Yes. Yeah. I don't think that it is the end all be all that at one time it was believed that it was going to be, you know, this is where all new business is going to come from and all that kind of stuff. I don't really buy that. but I do think it's a great way to stay engaged and emotionally connected with previous people or part of kind of our company family. You know, it's a great way to engage our staff and our clients. Like, I think there's a lot of opportunity from a branding standpoint in social media. I think social media, I mean, you can't really deny that anymore, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
every social media is a part of life. Mm-hmm. And in business, you have to play in it, yeah, whether you like it or not. Although that said, I hate Twitter, and I just
don't, man,
don't
I
do it.
Eric, I've been trying to figure it out. For years, I've been trying to figure out like how does it work? Why does it exist? And I'm just starting to get it. And if for work, like personally, if it was just me personally, I wouldn't care. But I'm like, I got to reach out to people. I got to figure this out. And I'm just starting to figure it out. But
I look forward to seeing what you say, because I have seen no evidence from anyone anywhere that in our industry there is any connection between Twitter and increased revenue.
Yeah, just, you like, know, none. It may not. Here's the thing about Twitter: it may not sell more trips, but it will help create connections with other people and brands.
Yeah, that's, I think, the power of that one is, yeah, you know, there's some people in my life who have been really successful with Twitter, uh-huh, and it's opened up doors, like unbelievable doors. Here's one. My daughter, who is 5, just about turned 6, has really gotten into drawing and coloring stuff. And so she's like, you know, found these videos on YouTube that teach you how to draw, and she follows along and does it. And she drew this Star Wars character as a stormtrooper or something. And as a proud parent for a 5-year-old, it was amazing, right? Like, I thought it was, I couldn't draw it. Let's put it that way. And my wife took a picture of it and said, you know, Scout's working on her drawings, love Star Wars, whatever, posted on Twitter. Well, like an hour later, Mark Hamill, who plays Luke, wow, Skywalker in all the movies, comments on it and says, Scout, that's a great drawing.
That is, you cool. That, like, see, that's why Twitter's cool. That is exactly why I think that's where the power is.
I think that piece of, exactly. And I think that the ability, it flattens the world a little bit, right? Like, yeah, you can communicate with all sorts of people.
Yeah.
That part of it is really cool. I just, my problem with Twitter is you have to be paying attention to it. It's not like Facebook where I can get on and it'll just prioritize everything from the last 10 days. If, yeah, I've been on there in 10 days,
yeah,
Twitter, it's like, if you're not on it, if you're not live on the conversation, it feels like you're out of the conversation. Yeah. That's my problem with it. But
well, this, I want to try to wrap this conversation up. That's pretty cool. I think I like that. And I think that's, you know, I tagged Opt Outside in a Twitter post last week, and yeah, REI liked it. And I'm sure it's like an intern in a basement liking every single Opt Outside, but whatever. But I felt special. REI is a big deal. You know, like a big national brand liked my tweet. So, you know, it makes you feel good. And, but to have Mark Hamill, you know, write a post, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I'm sure he's sitting around like, as well, looking
at Twitter. Or his assistant, who knows, you know?
But I bet in that case, I mean, that's pretty cool. For a movie star to see something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not exactly working right now. You know,
it was pretty special for my daughter, for sure.
Yeah.
So she thought that was pretty neat.
Well, I want to try to wrap this one up. I want to make this claim again. I hear a lot of social media debates on, you know, when I go boating and people talking about it. And I'm just going to say, like, hey, everyone, just, it's cool. Post. Like, people like to see your stuff. It's fine. It's the new world. Like, don't fight it. It's kind of like fighting cell phones in 2000. You know, I think we're all going to be doing it here in 5 or 10 years. And I'm embracing it. I'm trying to embrace it. So I'm going to make the claim that social media is totally cool. And please, people, keep doing it, because it helps me know what's going on.
I will say, Zach, I enjoy following your feed. I think, you know, it's always fun. I enjoy being able to follow what my friends are up to and just, uh-huh, see what kind of adventures they're doing and that sort of thing. It's a great way to see what what's going on in other people's lives and what kind of fun things they're out doing.
Yeah, then we don't have to talk. When I see you, I can just be like, hey, what's up? Like, hey, cool.
I can comment on whatever ridiculous thing I saw you doing. Like, now we all of a sudden have this, we have a conversation opener, because I know what we have this, you know, I know what's going on in your life.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the thing, is people say it takes away from conversation, right? Like, oh, I already know what you're doing, why even ask? But you can just start a conversation with, hey, I saw you in Kyrgyzstan last month, let's talk about that. You know, or, man, I saw you bike this trail, Like, I've been there too. So I think people think it takes away from conversation, but it may open the doors for more information.
Yeah. I think it is what it is these days, you know.
Yeah.
We're not gonna fight social media. The best way, the only way you can fight it is to shut your phone off and go boating.
Which
and leave your phone in the car.
Isn't realistic. Well, leaving your phone in your car is realistic. I think most people do. But, you know, I bet in 10 years everybody will have their phone with them. You know, because it's also a great way if you have an emergency to make a phone call to get help.
No, it's a safety thing, and it's the best camera. So
it's the best camera.
I take mine.
Yeah. And when I want to know the length of a run, if I'm curious, I'll turn Strava on. And because I'm like, I've always wondered how long that actually is. And actually, when you're in Kyrgyzstan, I turned Strava on for a run. And the next day, my friend was like, oh, hey, how long was that run? And it was like 7 miles. And I think it was only 3.5 or something. And I'm like, that seems weird. It didn't seem like 7 miles. And then I forgot that we had run up and down the trail multiple times to scout things. And so it made a 3.5 mile run 7 miles. So
holy moly.
Yeah.
It sounded, from what I heard, it sounded like one of the big conversations should be how long was that hike out? Really was the big question mark on some of those things.
Well, yeah, and I used Strava for when I'm hiking into a run. I was like, it already says that the hiking's 2 miles, but I want to really know how long the hiking is. So Strava's a great way to measure distances. Like on the when I guide Middle Fork trips, you know, I don't always know. People like, how far is the Loon Creek? And I'm like, like 1.5 miles. You know, but now I know. You know, I take Strava on these hikes now, and I can tell people, oh, it's 1.34 miles.
That kind of takes the fun out of it, though, right? I mean,
for a guide perspective, like making things, like the fun of making things up.
I think fun for everybody, right?
No, people want to know how far it is. When they ask how far is something, they want the answer. They don't want me to say, it's like 1.5 miles-ish. You know, like if it's a big climb, you know, there's one big hike on the Middle Fork where you climb like 1500 feet, you know, it's only like 0.7 miles. Like, how far is this hike? I'm like, it's only 0.7 miles. It's good information.
No, when we go backcountry skiing, I always like to know or biking too. Like what is the climb? What's the uphill look like? You know, cause that helps me know how hard out of the gate to go.
Yeah.
Although these days it's just go slow no matter what, because it's gonna be like, you can make it regardless.
Well, let's move on to gear of the week.
Yeah. Zach, what's your gear of the week?
Well, I have been negligent to talk about one of my favorite things, and that's the Sawyer MXG Ore. Have you tried that ore before, Eric?
Oh, yeah. We've got a bunch of them.
Do you have square tops?
Oh, wait. Did you say MXG?
MXG.
Oh, we have MXX. I don't have an MXG. So, we do have some square tops, though.
Okay, so that basically it's – so the MX ores from Sawyer are composite ores. Like I'm a wood guy. I use wood ores forever. That's what I learned on. And I swore by them for years and made fun of people that use composites. And I finally made the switch, and I'm just a huge fan of their composite ores because they're light. They're stiff. If you break, you know, the ore shaft, you only have to replace the shaft, not the shaft and the blade.
Yeah.
So where wood ores – when you break it, wood ore, it's broken. Where now you break an ore, you break half the ore, and you have to replace half of it. So they're more expensive. They're more affordable to replace. And within Sawyer, their nomenclatures are weird. There's the MXG, which stands for graphite, which is the carbon ore, which is the lightest, stiffest ore they make. And there's the MX.
That's that new one, right? It's full carbon?
It's been around for a while. Yeah, they just –
oh, really?
I don't think they advertise it that well. They don't – there's also the MXFG, which the F is fiberglass. So it's fiber. That one's fiberglass and carbon. The MXG is full carbon. And
I thought their full carbon was a brand new. I thought that was a new thing.
No, I don't think so. I'm a little confused by the nomenclature sometimes.
Yeah.
But I have been running these ores, and you know, everybody swears by the square tops, and yeah, I'm the same way. They look cool. It's a cool branding thing. If you're a drift boater, like, definitely the way to go, I think. I'm not a drift boater, so I don't know. But these MXG...
If you're in a big oars, like 11-foot oars, they're pretty nice. Like in 9-foot oars, I think they're ridiculous.
The square
but like
tops?
11 or, yeah, the square tops. Like 11 or 11-foot, 11.5-foot oars, they're pretty sweet.
But same thing with the MX. The MXGs, they make an 11-foot oars. And I've been using just these pretty much all the time. And I just think that it's the way to go for whitewater. And I don't like flex when I row. And flex is a waste of energy. Like, energy is lost in that flex. I want the ore to go in the water and and move the water. I don't want to build up energy and whatever people say about flex. So I think that MX is the MXG in particular is the stiffest, lightest ore you can get. You know, it should be the gold standard, and not that many people know about it. So my gear of the week is the Sawyer MXG, and I'd recommend everybody checking that ore out if you're looking for something new.
I'll check out the MXG. We run MXXs.
MX. I think MX.
MX.
M. Just MX. Just MX.
It's their, yeah, I think it's just MX.
I think that's the fiberglass version.
It's the fiberglass version. Okay. We've run those forever, like as long as I can remember. That's basically all we've run in OTT. We've got, you know, 40 of them or whatever. Like that's our ore to go to from a commercial standpoint. And they're stiff, like they're durable. You know, we break blades. We have renters break blades left and right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the shaft is still good to go. Yep. Or they break the shaft and then you can retrieve the blade.
Yep, exactly. So the the graphite one, so you have the fiberglass one. The graphite one that I'm talking about is, I'm pretty sure it's lighter. It's definitely, it's even stiffer. It's more durable, but it also costs more.
Maybe we do have MX. We have some MXGs, I think.
Yeah, so it's like, I think you're paying more for it, but you're getting some more durability and stiffness.
Yeah. And especially in a gear boat or a heavy boat, I'm with you. I like a really stiff oar.
Yeah.
Like in a lighter boat, like a 14 or something like that, I run my smokers like on 14s. I run my smokers all day long because I like on a lighter boat, I like the flex personally. But, you know,
I'm anti-flex. Teach their own. I don't think you ever want flex in whitewater. I think that's just my opinion, though. We can debate that for an hour. I could see in a drift boat wanting the flex, but I don't understand drift boats. And that's more, I think drift boating is more of an art, and running a raft is more of a science. It's more of a, just like put your oar in the water and pull. But that's a debate we can have later, Eric. I know you're.
Yeah. Gonna, I'd be curious to, that's an interesting, yeah. We'll have to come back to that one. We'll return. So for my gear of the week, I just went on a November lower salmon trip, where it hovered around freezing most of the time. And, I was reminded how amazing bogs are on wintertime river trips.
Oh, bogs are so 2018.
Bogs are the best. They're warm, they're dry. Like, you know, you're roaming around in the sand, doesn't matter. Like,
wait, in case people don't know what bogs are, will you explain what they are?
Yeah, basically insulated rubber boots. I mean, like, there's probably more to them than that, but in the grand scheme of things, they're an insulated rubber boot that, you know, you can walk into water reasonably deep with. They stay dry, but they're insulated, so they're warm. Like, I was out, you know, snow blowing the driveway this morning in them. My feet are toasty warm, versus like your standard sort of cheap old school rubber boots that are not insulated at all. You know, nice soft cushy sole, like really comfortable, warm, easy to slip on, easy to get off. Like, they even have this little thing on the back that if you want to take them off without having to reach down or whatever, you can, like, it's designed to put your step on with your toes to keep the heel down when you pull your foot up and out. Like, they're clever. I love them. Great. I wouldn't, like, we talk about winter river trips or even Hawaii trips. Mm-hmm. Like, that is my piece of, you know, as I'm talking to people who've never been on a kind of cold weather river trip, it's like, okay, just bring on your normal stuff, warm weather, bring rubber boots. Like, make sure you have ideally bogs.
Do you wear them? Do you wear them while you're rowing?
It depends on the trip. Like, any sort of significant whitewater, you know, if there's a chance you're going to swim, they're probably not the best. I mean, you could get them off if you were swimming, but
they could be unsafe, right? They could make you sink.
Yeah, they totally could
make you sink.
Yeah, it'd be like wearing cowboy boots or whatever else. Like, you shouldn't probably do it. But like, we did the Grand Ron, you know, last spring break, and it was cold out. And, you know, it's a class 2 river, like, feel pretty comfortable. I'm not going out of the boat. Like, I definitely wore my bogs all day. And we were up, I took our snout boat on the lower salmon. So it was up on this big, you know, 25-foot snout boat motoring along. And I wore my bogs on there because it was the same thing, like warm, dry, happy.
But if it's a hard river, you might put them in like a bag.
Oh yeah.
When you get to camp, like, throw on those on really quick.
Yeah, like if I'm doing it in Illinois, I'm wearing my dry suit all day, and I'm throwing my bogs. Personally, what I do is I take a trash bag, and I throw my bogs in the trash bag in my dry bag. so that if they're a little sandy or wet or whatever in the morning when I'm done putting them in my dry bag, then they're segregated from the rest of my stuff with a, just a cheap, you know, trash bag option.
So our guide's uniform this last spring was Carhartt's Melanzana, those like fleeces from Colorado, Smith yep. sunglasses, and Boggs.
Yeah.
That's everybody's
wearing. I do Boggs, mountain khakis, typically a black diamond fleece because I get them for cheap from my brother who works there, and Smith sunglasses. But, you know, yeah, same basic thing.
So
it's a good outfit.
The Boggs look cool to me. I want some, but I don't want to just follow everybody else.
You do. They're outstanding. I wear mine from now until April. I will literally wear mine every day.
No, I get that I want them. I do want them secretly. Don't tell anybody. But I don't want to be like if I have to wear the same uniform as everybody else, it's weird to me. I have to have different shoes just so I don't stand out.
But what you're saying is if Boggs was to send you a pair for, you know, because they happen to listen to a podcast that was on the internet, you would probably wear them. And because you Instagram everything, you'd probably Instagram it too, right? That's what you're saying.
Maybe.
But you're not going to go out of your way to buy something. Did everybody wear something for free.
Did you say you were going to wear them every day for the winter?
I will probably, like, realistically, from now until April, it's very likely I will wear mine every day.
It's because
I live in the snow.
Yeah, that's why though, right? Because you live in the snow.
Yeah, they're like the go-to thing here because now that it's snowy out, you take your shoes off when you come inside, and you can just slip them on and off. I can traipse out in the snow; they're warm, so they're like the go-to. You go to the grocery store, and literally everybody has on like slip-on boots or snow boots or a pair of Boggs or something like that.
Yeah, like Sorels back in the day were what everybody wore.
Yeah, I mean, I have a pair of Sorels and I love them, but it's such a nightmare to get on and off compared to these. Like, that's the beauty of these is I'm going out to get firewood. I can just slip them on, walk outside, walk back inside, not have to set the firewood down, slip them off without getting my hands down. They're great.
But with Sorels, you don't have to tighten them up. You just, like, put your feet in and you don't have to lace them up and get firewood.
Yeah, but I can't get mine off without sitting down and, like, using my hands, even if I don't lace them.
All right, enough of that. We're on crazy tangents now.
Yeah, crazy tangents.
This is a good sign we need to wrap this one up and put a bow on it.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Well, just going to say, I'm sorry. We got off on some tangents.
No, it's good. It's good. I think it's funny. I just think it's like time. I think it's time we wrap this one up. I hope the tangents are good. Oh, and I want to mention, this isn't a tangent. This is on topic. I'm personally really fascinated by the social media discussion. I've been thinking about it a lot, and so if any of you are still listening to the podcast at this point, I would love to have viewer mail with your thoughts about this and to maybe pick this discussion up again with some viewer mail and Priscilla on board. Because I bet Priscilla has some interesting insights.
Yeah, for sure. Priscilla definitely has some interesting insights. Be fun to talk to her about. So that's the rivertalkpodcast@gmail.com. Send over your rants, both positive and negative. Maybe we'll talk about them next time. So thanks for listening today. Hopefully there's some water out there. So people are out boating. So it's good to see. We're watching all of it on social media and being jealous. Hopefully you're on your way out to the river or coming back from the river. And check us out next week. We'll be back.